This is Focus 580, hour number two of the program. Good morning. Welcome to this part of the show. My name is David Inge. Glad to have you with us. This is our morning talk program. The producers for the show, Harriet Williamson and Martha Deal. Kyle Mabry is at the controls this morning. Well, after a very, very long battle in the state of Minnesota, the question of the Senate seat there has finally been settled. Al Franken will be the next United States Senator from Minnesota. And the reason that's important is, well, not only is it important, I'm sure, to the people of Minnesota, but it's also important to the Democratic Party, because now what this does, it gives them a veto-proof majority in the Senate, 60 votes. And it's perhaps just another thing to add to the list of factors that currently have put the Democratic Party in a very strong position and the Republican Party in a less strong position. And certainly ever since last year's election, with the election of Barack Obama, people in the Republican Party have been talking about where they are, where they've been, and where they are headed, and perhaps how they can strengthen the party and achieve further victories or achieve victories once again when we come to the midterm elections and then next time we do a presidential election. So we thought this morning we would try to spend a little bit of time talking about the Republican Party, where it is right now and where it is going. And our guest for the show is Ross Douthat. He writes for the New York Times. He's an op-ed columnist for the paper. He, for a number of years before that, worked for The Atlantic magazine. He was a senior editor at The Atlantic. And then in April, he became online an op-ed columnist for The New York Times, replacing Bill Kristol on the editorial page there. He is the youngest regular op-ed writer in the paper's history. He is also the co-author of a book that he wrote with Rehan Salam that was first published, I believe, last year and now has come out in paper. It's been out for about a month with a new foreword by the authors. The title of that book is Grand New Party, the subtitle How Republicans Can Win the Working Class and Save the American Dream. It's published by Anchor Books. So if you're interested in reading the book, you can seek it out in the bookstore or in the library. And as we talk this morning, of course, questions, comments are welcome. The number here in Champaign-Urbana, 333-9455, and toll-free, 800-222-9455. So at any point here, you're certainly welcome to call with questions, comments. The only thing that we ask of callers is that people are brief in their comments. And just, you know, we ask that so we can get in as many callers as possible and keep the show moving. But anyone who is listening is welcome to call. Again, 333-9455, toll-free, 800-222-9455. Mr. Douthat, hello.
Hello, David. Thanks for having me.
Well, thanks very much for being with us. Again, we certainly appreciate it. There are a lot of things we talk about here. Obviously, when you talk about where the party stands now, the Republican Party stands, they have lost for the moment the White House, control of Congress, and perhaps some of the initiative when it comes to making policy. And
that's putting it mildly.
I know, it's putting it mildly. And also, if you look at various kinds of polls, or for example, one that I mentioned when I was promoting the program was in April, Washington Post ABC News poll, of those people that they surveyed, 21% said they identified themselves as Republicans, and that apparently was the lowest response in that poll for more than 25 years. So all of that comes together to say, well, the fortunes of the party are at a low ebb right now. What do you think that's really all about, and is that mostly dissatisfaction with the last administration, or is that dissatisfaction with what people perceive to be as the central sort of ideas of conservatism?
Well, I think there are, let's say there are three things going on here, three trends at work that are driving the Republican Party's popularity to extremely low levels. And the first has to do with just sort of the inevitable arc of political movements, which is to say that a political movement rises to power usually on a set of hot-button issues and then often succeeds in changing the conversation, changing policy on those issues, but then becomes a victim of its own success. And so in the case of the Republican Party, the Republican majorities of the past 25 years were built on issues like sky-high crime rates. They were built on high marginal tax rates for the middle class, and on a lot of these fronts, the GOP won the battle, in a sense. I mean, if you look, for instance, at tax rates, if you compare tax rates on the middle class today to where tax rates were when Ronald Reagan was running for president, they're about 50% lower. Similarly, Republicans won election after election in the 70s and 80s because it was perceived that the Democrats had misgoverned the country and couldn't restore public order, couldn't deal with rising crime. Today, crime rates are as low as they've been since the early 1960s and seem to be staying low even in an economic downturn. And so these are successes for the Republicans, but they take away issues. And you can see it in Republican campaigns that Republican politicians, they want to talk as if the year is still 1979, 1980, and they're all always running against Jimmy Carter. But the country has changed, and the problems have changed, and the party needs to adapt. So that's problem number one. Problem number two is, as you said, just the hangover from a unpopular and perceived to be very unsuccessful presidency. And that's something that is probably more of a short-term problem. The shadow of George W. Bush hangs very heavy over the party right now. It probably won't in 4 or 5 years or so, though obviously you never know. The shadow of Herbert Hoover did hang very heavily over the Republican Party for a long time. The Bush administration was perceived as being responsible for an unsuccessful war in Iraq, and then was perceived as being responsible for a massive economic catastrophe in the past year or so, and that's a tough thing for any party to deal with. But then the third thing, and this is probably the biggest long-term problem for the Republicans, is just that the demographics of the United States are changing, and they're changing in ways that tend to disadvantage the GOP. The current GOP majority was built on the votes largely of white, middle-class Christians, and America is becoming less white, somewhat less middle class, and somewhat less Christian. And so if you look at groups, and you know, the groups that are growing tend to be Democratic constituencies, and the groups that are shrinking demographically tend to be Republican constituencies. And that's, you know, again, all of these things are reversible and changeable, but that's a big long-term problem for the Republicans.
Yeah. The two things that you point to, if we ask this question, okay, what motivates voters' choice? And we look back to the last election. Very, very clearly, as you say, there were a lot of Americans who were very unhappy with the war in Iraq. They were very unhappy with the economy, the administration, and so then the Republican Party kind of gets the blame. And also, we have to say that in Barack Obama, we had an extraordinary candidate, a very special candidate, and what appeared to be a very well-run campaign. Also, people have raised questions about, well, was Senator McCain a good choice? Were mistakes made in his campaign? You sort of have to figure those things in. But I guess I find myself wondering whether you think, how many people you think really go into the polling place with an idea about where, ideologically speaking, the parties stand, what they stand for, and you know how much it really is. Either if things are going along okay, well, maybe people feel okay with the status quo. But if they're really unhappy, then what they say is, well, these guys are no good. They're bums. They screwed everything up. So let's get these guys out of there. So you vote for, and that's simply the vote for change,
right,
without exactly being sure what it is you're voting for.
Right. Well, look, and clearly, American elections, by and large, and there are exceptions, and there was something of an exception recently in the year 2000, but by and large, you can determine the outcome of American presidential elections by looking at the economic circumstances that the incumbent party is dealing with. And if an incumbent party is dealing, you know, has the economic wind at its back and, you know, economic growth and, you know, growing incomes and so forth, they're probably going to win. And if they don't, they're probably going to lose. So there is that baseline that would have made 2008 an almost impossible task for any Republican candidate, no matter what the broader circumstances. That being said, I think there's one poll that I think is very, very telling. It was taken repeatedly throughout the campaign, and it's the poll where they ask people, which of these two candidates, Barack Obama and John McCain, understands the problems of people like you? And again throughout the campaign, Barack Obama had a 10, 20, 30 point advantage in those numbers. And again, some of that just has to do with, yeah, the economy was bad, the Republicans were the incumbent party, but some of it also has to do with the fact that Republicans in general, and John McCain specifically, haven't found a way to talk about sort of kitchen table domestic policy issues. And those were the issues that were at the forefront of voters' minds in the campaign. And voters listened to John McCain and didn't think that he had anything to say about them.
Yeah. There's one real quick, and let me ask a kind of a follow-up, then I have a caller I want to get to. They, after the Obama victory, a lot of Republicans got engaged in this sort of agonized process of self-examination, saying, well, where did we go wrong? Who are we? Have we lost our way? How do we present ourselves? And the Democrats did the same thing when
George, after 2004.
The Democrats did the same thing. So, and I suppose that's natural. If you've fallen into a ditch, you say, well, okay, how did we get here and how do we climb back out? I guess I just wonder whether that kind of conversation really, does that resonate at all with average people, or is that something that preoccupies the political class? People like me, people like you, who think about politics and who talk about politics, and that's an inside the beltway kind of conversation. And as far as the rest of the country is concerned, you know, they're not paying any attention to that.
I mean, I think it's definitely an inside the beltway conversation. That doesn't mean, though, that it isn't important. One way to look at it is those kind of conversations are a necessary but not sufficient thing for a party to do if it wants to get back into power. So if you look back, I mean, I think a better model for the Republicans really is the Democratic Party in the 70s and 80s, right, when the Democrats had been in power for, you know, 30, 40 years since the New Deal. They took their power for granted. They lost to Ronald Reagan, and they entered into a period of repeated presidential-level defeats. And there was a big, important debate within the Democratic Party about how do they learn from these defeats. Now, most Americans weren't listening to that debate, but eventually that debate had an impact on the way that, for instance, Bill Clinton ran his presidential campaign in 1992. So Bill Clinton was influenced by one side in those debates, and he used their ideas, I think, effectively to reach out to voters. So it's a sort of step-by-step process. You want to have these arguments so that politicians can then draw on the ideas that are floated in these arguments in the future.
Our guest in this hour, Focus 580, Ross Douthat. He is online and op-ed columnist for The New York Times. He's also written for Wall Street Journal, Weekly Standard, Claremont Review of Books, GQ, Slate, other publications. He's the co-author of the book Grand New Party, How Republicans Can Win the Working Class and Save the American Dream, published by Anchor, first published last year. And we talked about this book with him and his co-author, Rehan Salam, about a year ago, and the book is now out in paperback, so you can look for it. And questions, comments are welcome, 333-9455. Toll-free, 800-222-9455. We have a caller here in Champaign, line one. Hello.
Yes, this is great. My question to you, and of course I'm a card-carrying Democrat, maybe right of center, but my question to you is how can the Republican Party, in light of the demographics, and I think you made a great observation about the demographic change, how can a party that basically talks in shibboleths, limited government, tax cuts, Ronald Reagan, as the cure-all for all the problems that exist in the year 2009. I think that narrow point of view means nothing in terms of the garden variety issues that most Americans face today. In fact, most of the Americans in the Democratic base now don't even remember Ronald Reagan. So until the Republicans expand in terms of coming up with ideas and start, instead of relying on these stale statements like tax cuts as a cure-all for every problem we have, limited government, when George Bush pushed that to the edge, conservative foreign policy, which we are now in two wars thanks to George Bush, and Ronald Reagan. And as an African-American, I remember Ronald Reagan starting his campaign in 1980 in Philadelphia, Mississippi, and talking about states' rights. And I will never forgive him for that. And I think you know why. That's all I have.
All right. Well, go ahead and take that on however you like.
Well, for listeners who don't know, Philadelphia, Mississippi was the site, I believe, of the murder of several civil rights workers in the 1960s. That's what the caller is referring to. And mm-hmm. it was, And you know, broadly speaking, I think he's right. I think the thing to remember is that it's hard for parties to shift because you know the reasons that Republicans talk in these shibboleths, as the caller called them, is that you know these are the arguments on which Republicans have won elections for 25 or 30 years. And you know, it's easy to say, oh well, Republicans should talk about something besides tax cuts. And I think pretty clearly they have to talk about something besides tax cuts. But it's harder then to sort of shift, you know, a large political beast that's been in place for 25 or 30 years. And you saw this again with the Democrats in the 1980s. If you watched, for instance, Walter Mondale's 1984 presidential campaign, it was very easy to see what was going wrong with Mondale's campaign. I mean, he was standing there in debates with Ronald Reagan promising to raise Americans' taxes at a time when it was clear that the public mood had shifted against middle-class tax increases. But nonetheless, Mondale ran the campaign he ran because that was the kind of campaign that the Democratic Party at that moment was capable of running. And so, again, the caller's absolutely right that the Republican Party can't talk in the same way that it's become accustomed to talking for a long time. But on the other hand, you know, that's a hard shift, I think, a lot of times for a political party and movement to make.
Again, questions are welcome. 333-9455, toll-free 800-222-9455. I was going back and looking at some of your columns. I was looking at one that appeared in early May, and I think that really what motivated this column at that point was the move of Arlen Specter from the Republican Party to the Democratic Party and all of the upheaval that it caused. But one of the things in the column that really struck me right early on was your writing that you can't have a successful party without centrists. And that seems to be an issue with the Republican Party. That is, it seems that the party has moved more towards the right, become, I don't know if it's true to say more conservative, but at least it seems to be dominated more by social conservatives as opposed to fiscal conservatives. And I think that there are some people who would say, well, that's part of the problem. Is that, in fact, do you think, part of the problem?
Well, there are a couple things going on. Right now, the Republican Party is dominated by fiscal conservatives. In fact, this has not been the case, I would say, for the last 10 years or so. It certainly wasn't the case during the Bush administration. But at the moment, the dominant voices in the Republican Party are all primarily fiscally rather than socially conservative. And that's largely a reaction to Barack Obama's presidency and the fact that, you know, the biggest debates in the country right now are debates over how big the government should be and how much money the Democrats should be spending. Mm-hmm. So if people were looking for a revival of fiscal conservatism in the Republican Party, they've gotten it. That doesn't necessarily mean, though, that the Republican Party has moved towards the center. In fact, in a lot of ways, since the election, the party has arguably moved more to the right. It's just moved to the right on fiscal questions rather than social questions. So I guess what I'm trying to say is that it's a very complicated picture. But I think one useful way to look at it is the presidency of George Bush, to a lot of Americans, looks like a presidency that was, you know, very right-wing. To a lot of conservatives, it doesn't look that way. And that's because Bush very explicitly set out to move the party to the center on a number of fronts. And if you look at Bush's signal domestic policy initiatives, especially in the first term, we're looking at No Child Left Behind, you're looking at the expansion of Medicare to include a prescription drug benefit, and then in the second term you've had immigration reform, which was certainly not an attempt at a right-wing policy initiative. And all of this, you know, this all went supposedly under the rubric of quote, compassionate conservatism. All of this was a very explicit attempt to say, okay, well, we can't have a party that's too far to the right. We need to be a center-right party. We need to find that sort of center-right majority. The thing was that those domestic policy initiatives didn't become the defining features of the Bush years to most Americans. The defining features were the war in Iraq, the mishandling of Hurricane Katrina, and the broader economic picture. But so you have this weird situation where conservatives feel that the Bush years, you know, if you go to a lot of conservatives and you say, man, we need to move to the center, they'll say, well, we already tried that in the Bush years. Now we need to try something else. Meanwhile, the rest of the country thinks the Republican Party needs to move to the center. And they're, in a weird way, they're both right. Like, the Bush administration was both, it moved to the center on some fronts, moved to the right on other fronts. And the problem was, it was just unsuccessful across the board. But so anyway, it's a very difficult landscape to navigate, if, especially if you're a Republican politician, because you can come out and say, well, I want to be a centrist. But then, you know, that remaining 20% who still identify with the Republican Party are very conservative, and we'll see that as sort of a return to the failed policies of the Bush years. So, you know, there's no easy way out of this, I guess.
Unlike the former vice president, who has been out and defending the record of the previous administration and being critical of the Obama administration, and we can talk some more about that in a minute, but I raise him in contrast to the president, the former president, Mr. Bush, who seems virtually to have vanished. And I wonder what you make of that. I think it would be natural for a former president to have a leadership position in the party, unless, of course, people were so unhappy with his leadership as president that they'd said that they would just as well say that he'd, you know, just as well that he would vanish. I wonder what you make of his
well, I mean, I think his disappearance isn't, it's Cheney's prominence that's surprising. I mean, Bush is following the pattern generally set by ex-presidents, which is, you know, refrain from any but the most gingerish criticism of your successor. Whereas it's Cheney who's sort of breaking these sort of weird Washington rules where you're not supposed to criticize your successor, and I think that has a lot to do probably just with temperamental differences between Bush and Cheney, that, you know, Bush is sort of fundamentally, you know, in spite of perhaps some of his reputation, he's a less combative and partisan figure in a way than Cheney is. Cheney is a guy who relishes a debate. If you watch the debates in 2000 and 2004, you know, Cheney's debates against Joe Lieberman and John Edwards, it was clear that was something Dick Cheney liked to do, which was never really true of George W. Bush.
Speaking of the former vice president, some people, I think, within the party were really unhappy with him emerging as a kind of spokesman for the party, defending the record of the past administration and attacking the Obama administration. And I think that there were some Republicans who, and I think they actually even came right out and said it, wished that he would just go away. I wonder, how did that represent broadly an attitude within the party? I mean, were there some people who were publicly saying, yes, tone it down, Mr. Cheney, but you know, when they were all alone on their own, were actually cheering him?
I think it's more the reverse. There were a lot of people who said publicly, well, of course, you know, it's good that the vice president is speaking out, and privately they were thinking, I wish he'd go away. I mean, I think the interesting thing with Cheney attacking Obama is that in the short term, he was reasonably effective. You know, he sort of knocked Obama off his game, I think, with some of his criticisms on detention policy in Guantanamo Bay. And this led into the Senate's refusal to appropriate funds to close Guantanamo Bay, which is actually one of the bigger defeats that Obama has had so far. So in sort of the short term, Cheney can be, in spite of being an unpopular figure overall, I think he can be a very effective critic of Obama. I think the problem for the Republicans is that they don't, you know, there's only so many short-term battles they can win with sort of slashing criticism of Obama. Ultimately, they need to get beyond the Bush-era debates, and Dick Cheney is clearly not the guy to do it. So, you know, even if having Cheney out there attacking Obama wins you a legislative victory, in the long run, it pushes further off the day when the Republican Party gets rebranded as something other than Dick Cheney's party.
Yeah. Well, that gets to this question, perhaps, of who it is that speaks for the party or who leads the party. And certainly there are people like him who are, when they speak, people listen. They get a lot of attention. They're lightning rod kind of individuals. But who truly is leading the party, or is anybody leading the party?
Well, no, nobody's leading the party. But this shouldn't be that surprising. We don't have a parliamentary system in the United States. There aren't elected leaders of the party. You have the, you know, committee chairs. Michael Steele, obviously, at this point, is the chair of the Republican Party. But they have never traditionally exercised anything like a true leadership role. I mean, in the 1990s, when Bill Clinton was president, it wasn't like the chair of the Republican Party. It may have been Haley Barbour in Clinton's first term, but I may be misremembering that. It's not like he was perceived as the leader of the Republicans. I mean, they're natural political leaders in the House and Senate. John Boehner and Mitch McConnell, but they're not terribly charismatic figures, and they don't have any national constituency. So basically, you just have a lot of fighting, and you also have people who are well known before who can come back and get media airtime. So your Dick Cheney's, also your Newt Gingrich's, and so on, and obviously Rush Limbaugh as well, are sort of filling the vacuum, but it's still a vacuum.
And so are there any, say, leading contenders?
Well, I mean, I think that, we just, in a way, the party probably just mucks along till the 2012 election, and then whoever emerges, the primary campaign becomes sort of a battle to become the leader of the Republican Party. If the Republicans make substantial gains in the House and Senate in the midterm elections, then I think you would see a figure like, say, Eric Cantor, who's the House Minority Whip, who's sort of the young, up-and-coming leader of the House Republicans. I think he would become, he might not become minority leader, but if they make gains, he'll become a much more prominent figure. But more likely, you're just sort of gearing up for the battles of 2012. I mean, for instance, who was the leader of the Democratic Party, right, in 1990? It's sort of hard to say. Then Bill Clinton became the leader of the Democratic Party, and remained in that position for a long time.
The historically, maybe it doesn't happen every time, but I guess enough so that it's kind of a given that party in power loses seats in midterm elections. At this moment, though, it seems that the relative strength of the two parties is such that I guess I wouldn't really expect it. Maybe the Democrats might lose some seats, but I wouldn't think that there'd be much of a change in their position in 2010. Do you think that there might?
I think there might. So much of it, the problem for Republicans right now is that they're more unpopular than they even should be. That they're sort of, that 20% figure you cited is well beneath even the threshold. The Republican Party is less popular than, how to phrase this, they're less popular than, there's more opposition to Obama than there is opposition to Obama that identifies with the Republican Party. But presumably when you get to an election, that gap closes because, we only have two parties, and if you don't agree with what the Democrats are doing, you're probably going to hold your nose and vote for the Republicans. And it's totally plausible to imagine that we'll get to 2010 and there will be widespread dissatisfaction with the Democrats. And that's just going to depend on really how the economy performs. And I think we're losing sight of that a little bit at the moment because of all the debates about complicated domestic policy legislation. Last week it was cap and trade, and then it'll be health care and so on. And obviously the long-term success of Obama's presidency hinges on whether he can get this legislation through. But the short-term success of his presidency in the Democratic Party just depends on the unemployment rate. And if the unemployment rate is 12% in the fall of, in the fall of 2010, which it probably won't be, but it could be, then Republicans are probably going to make gains.
Does that mean then one would expect that the Republicans they're not going to do anything to help, that they might not do something that would be perceived as being directly sort of obstructionist, but at the same time they're not going to do anything to help?
Well, but what do we mean by doing something to help, right? I mean, yes, you could say that Republicans, for instance, opposed the stimulus package because they want to see Barack Obama's presidency fail. But, Republicans, generally people, people's ideological interests and political interests align, at least in their own minds. And I don't think that that's how most Republicans were thinking about the stimulus. I think they were legitimately thinking that it was a bad idea that wouldn't stimulate the economy. And, frankly, here we are 4 or 5 months later, and unemployment numbers are coming in well above the projections the Obama administration made. And I'm I think the Republicans can claim at least a measure of vindication at the moment. Now, you know, all of these things are tremendously complicated, and we'll see what the picture looks like in 6 months. But yeah, Republicans are not going to be, you know, rushing with open arms to cut deals with Barack Obama. But it doesn't mean that they're, you know, necessarily trying to take down the country.
Yeah. Our guest in this hour of Focus 580 is Ross Douthat. He works for the New York Times now. He's on the op-ed page there of the paper, has been there since the spring of this year. Before that, he worked for a number of years as senior editor at The Atlantic. And also, his work has appeared in other places, The Wall Street Journal, Weekly Standard, GQ, Slate, Claremont Review of Books. He is the co-author, along with Rehan Salam, of the book Grand New Party, How Republicans Can Win the Working Class and Save the American Dream. That's the subtitle. Was published last year and now is out in paper with a new foreword by the authors. It's published by Anchor Books. And questions are welcome, 333-9455, toll free 800-222-9455. Something that I wanted to ask you about, people I think have, and not just recently, but I mean, I think probably for years now, people have been talking about the hardening of politics in the sense of becoming more partisan, and the idea more and more that it's if you're in a contest with someone, whether it maybe it's over legislation or you're talking about an election contest, winning is not just enough. Crushing the opponent is what you want to do. And I think that some people date this from the election of Bill Clinton, people at that time were talking, you know, waxing nostalgic about the days of bipartisanship when people in the Congress particularly worked with one another to get things done. And that since then we have more gridlock. We have both people on both sides more firmly entrenched in their ideologies. People don't want to work together. And so nothing gets done. And I wonder how you think about that kind of narrative, whether in fact that's true or whether we're maybe being overly nostalgic for another time when maybe it wasn't quite like that.
I think we're being overly nostalgic. I mean, I think that actually I would recommend a couple books to anyone who's sort of thinking about these issues. They're both books by a left-wing historian named Rick Perlstein, who's just a fantastic writer, and they're called Before the Storm and Nixon Land, and Nixon Land came out last year, and they're histories of American politics in the 1960s. And they paint a portrait of a society that, you know, was far, far more divided and violently divided. You know, you had serious, sustained domestic terrorism of both the left and right than anything that we've seen, even in the last 10 years. And, you know, the Bush administration was a very polarized period. But by the standards of the last 50 years of American life, it's considerably less polarized than American life in, you know, era of Richard Nixon, for instance. What has changed is that the parties have become more polarized. But there's a difference between having, which is to say, they're more ideologically rational. If you're right-wing, you're in the Republican Party. If you're left-wing, you're in the Democratic Party. And that didn't used to be the case. It used to be that the Democratic Party was a coalition of, you know, conservative white Southerners and liberal white Northerners, and which, you know, worked for all kinds of reasons. But it didn't make sense, that much sense ideologically. And, you know, that older era clearly had its advantages. There were a lot of bipartisan deals on a lot of subjects that could get cut because the parties were less ideologically cohesive. On the other hand, it's, you know, it's worth remembering that, for instance, on the issue of civil rights, the fact that the Democratic Party was both the party of, you know, liberal Northerners and the party of, you know, segregationist Southerners meant that it was awfully hard to get any kind of civil rights legislation through because you couldn't, you know, if you voted for the Democrat, if you were a Northern white liberal voting for the Democrats, you were effectively empowering Southern segregationists at the same time. You couldn't just pick a party and get your ideological goal the way you can now. So there are advantages, I'd say, to both a more rational and a less rational system, but I don't think we should overestimate the advantages of the past.
All right, let's talk with the caller in Effingham, line 4, on our toll-free line. Hello.
Yes, your last statement, I would like to comment on that, and then I have another comment. Depression, economic depression, racism, the condition of the country in 1940 And then came World War II, which demanded, in my opinion, the cooperation of everyone, no matter their ideology, and to get the war effort and to then include blacks into the military service as cannon fodder along with the rest. And somehow they had to cooperate. And up until the time of Reagan, when it began to come apart, and the Dick, you know, if you know the term Dixiecrat, but they were really right-wingers trying to ape the Democrats of the North and East. So that my comment with that. And the last is the now spreading of the American paradigm upon to the second and third world of this on this earth, and portraying that as some sort of advantageous dogma over what people in Asia, largely in the Middle East, have in their religious leaders, and the U.S. wants them to trade that for our brand of, I call it, democracy. Because what good does the vote do? What good does the representation? They sell themselves like any prostitute, and then it goes downhill and then leads to what we have here in the 21st century. Well, I'll ring up and listen. Thank you.
Well, clearly the caller comes from a different political place than you do.
I'd make a couple comments. I mean, I think the caller is absolutely right about the kind of unity and cohesion that the United States had during World War II, and I think that that persisted into the 1950s. And you really did have, you know, a unique era in American history running from basically the start of World War II until the late 1950s, an era of unprecedented stability and consensus. I think, though, that because that's, you know, World War II sort of falls across our past like a curtain in a way. And so we think of the post-World War II moment as the sort of definitive American past that we've, you know, fallen away from. But really, it was that era that was unusual. You know, if you look across the sweep of American history, polarization, you know, political feuds, you know, cracks in the consensus, wild riots, and all the rest of it. I mean, America has always been a fractious and contentious country. And I think that if we hold up the standard of, say, 1951 as the standard to which we always need to aspire to and need to lament if we aren't reaching, I think that that ignores the incredible unusualness of that moment. I mean, America had just come out of a massive worldwide war where everybody was pulling together, and you know, you had this unprecedented economic boom at that moment. You had economic power was unprecedented because every other country in the world was, you know, reduced to rubble. So, you know, our economy had virtually no competitors. I mean, that era is never coming back. And I understand, I understand the nostalgia for that period. I think it's justified in a lot of ways. But the world we live in now is the world that Americans have usually lived in. You know, polarization, ferment, and so on. So I guess that's sort of my big picture response to caller's comment.
All right. Our guest this morning in this hour, Ross Douthat. He works for the New York Times now. He appears on, he's an online and op-ed columnist for the Times, has been since April of this year. He took the place of Bill Kristol as a conservative voice on the Times editorial page. And before that, he worked for a number of years as senior editor at The Atlantic. He is the co-author of a book that was published last summer and now just is out in paper titled Grand New Party, How Republicans Can Win the Working Class and Save the American Dream. His co-author is Rehan Salam, and it's out now with a new foreword by the author, so you can look at that. And questions, again, are welcome, 333-9455, toll-free 800-222-9455. I want to return to something way back at the beginning of the program. You were talking about some of the trends that are in place that contribute to where the party is right at the moment. And one thing I want to have you talk a little bit more about is what you said was the biggest long-term problem, that was changing demographics in the country, where you sort of take a look at who is your characteristic Republican voter, or what had been your characteristic Republican voter and your characteristic Democratic voter. And you could see that the people who are the characteristic Democratic voters, their numbers are starting to grow. And the question is, I'm sure a lot of people in the Republican Party are saying, well, is there some way, how can we craft a message for and some policies for these people that might be more inclined to vote for a Democratic candidate? How can we at least get them to think about voting for a Republican candidate? How do you – and that, I think, really is what you and Rayhan are talking about in Grand New Party.
Right.
How can the Republican Party do that, do you think?
Well, I think there's two big choices available to the Republicans. If you're the party of the white middle class, right, which is basically the core of Republican strength right now, you can either try and, become a more – you can either try and get more whites, or you can try and get more middle and working class voters. So if you want to try and get more whites, basically Republicans need to try and win back some of the upper middle class, wealthier voters who are more socially liberal and fiscally conservative, who used to vote Republican and don't. So there you're talking about a lot of voters in states like Connecticut and California and so on, who probably would have voted for Ronald Reagan and are horrified by Sarah Palin. So that's one strategy. The alternative strategy is to sort of embrace your identity as a middle and working class party, and then you're probably going to be a little more socially conservative and a little more economically, I wouldn't say liberal, but a little more economically moderate, and you're going to try and appeal to Hispanics and African Americans who tend to be more socially conservative and a little more downscale than your average white voter. Over the long run, the Republican Party, on a candidate-by-candidate level, they can go in both directions. If you're a Republican in the Northeast, you should, try and be probably more socially liberal and fiscally conservative and try and win back some country club Republicans who are now voting for Democrats. And if you're a Republican in New Mexico, you probably need to be more socially conservative and middle-class friendly. But for the National Party, you probably have to move in one direction or the other. And our argument in Grand New Party is that, it would be better for the party and probably better for the country if the Republicans accepted that they're a working and middle-class party and focused on, building a center-right majority that basically tried to sort of take sort of generally socially conservative ideas about, the importance of the American family and so on, and find economic policies that match up with that. So, for instance, think about the tax code or the healthcare system and so on in explicitly family-friendly terms. But that's obviously, ours is just one view of the situation, and there are other directions the Republicans could go in.
Well, how do you one obstacle for the party would be the perception, and it may be unfair and not true. The perception, though, certainly among a lot of people, that it's possible that I guess that the Republican Party could be the party of the middle class, particularly the upper middle class, but somehow the Republican Party just isn't going to be the party of the working class, because it would be argued that the Republican Party has really never represented the interests of the working class.
Right, and I think that that's not really true. I think that actually, if you look back at the success of Ronald Reagan, it was actually built on winning the votes, winning many more middle and working class votes than any Republican had before. These are the famous Reagan Democrats, right, are the sort of your working class white guys from the Midwest who had always voted for Democrats and started voting for Reagan. And, there's a theory on the left, right, that they were tricked into this, that the Republicans fooled them by saying, vote for us because of cultural reasons, and meanwhile we'll stick it to you by cutting taxes for the rich and
right.
so on.
Yeah.
But if you actually look at the central issues, especially of those late 70s and early 80s campaigns, the tax cuts that Ronald Reagan was running on were tax cuts that were tax cuts for the working and middle class. Those sectors of the population perceived themselves, rightly, I think, to be overtaxed. in the late 70s and early 80s. And they perceived themselves to be overtaxed for the sake of ineffective government programs, and particularly an ineffective welfare system. And this was an important part of the Republican argument, and it was an argument that was pitched to the interests of the working class and the lower middle class. And the same was true with the debate over crime. I mean, I think that, you know, crime in the 70s and 80s was not something that was deeply affecting the lives of, you know, the rich country club set. It was deeply affecting the lives of working and middle class neighborhoods. So I think in the past, the Republican majority that's now disappeared was more than people acknowledge built on explicit appeals to working and middle class self-interest. I think you can imagine the Republican Party doing that again. I mean, just to take one for instance, right? Mm-hmm. There was the big Republican alternative to the stimulus package, which unfortunately, I shouldn't say that. The big intellectual conservative alternative to the stimulus package, which Republican politicians, I think, failed to sufficiently embrace, was the idea of a temporary, large-scale payroll tax cut instead of some of the large-scale government spending. Now, the payroll tax is the most regressive tax we have. It's a tax that, because it's capped at a certain level, it hits the working and middle class hardest. So in that instance, that conservative alternative would probably have put more money immediately into the pockets of the working class than what Barack Obama and the Democrats wanted to do. I think the problem for Republicans is that they aren't used to thinking in these terms, and they certainly aren't used to talking in those terms. And you could see it in the stimulus debate, and you know, that's changing the way you talk is a hard thing to do, but I think it's doable.
We have maybe about 3-4 minutes left. We have a caller here. I want to bring them in. Someone listening in Spring Bay. This is line 4, toll-free line. Hello.
Hello.
Yes?
I think it was Paul Krugman who said in one of his articles, referred to the Republicans as the party of stupid. And after listening this morning, I guess I really couldn't disagree with him.
That's my colleague.
What really
Paul
gets
Krugman
me about so. Republicans these days is they don't seem to want to take any responsibility for what they've done to this country. They've really run it into a ditch. Terry Schiavo, torture, deregulation, global warming, incompetence, arrogance, Katrina, Iraq, economic meltdown. It's the party of no. They have no ideas. And yet, there's been no apology. There's been no acceptance or recognition of what they've done, and they just keep saying no, 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 and it's status quo. So I'll hang up and listen to your response.
All
thank
right.
you.
That I'd say that certainly represents the kind of criticism that an awful lot of people make.
Yeah, no, I think so. I mean, you know, and look, I disagree with the caller on a number of the specific issues that he mentions, and I think that, you know, you can definitely overstate the Republican Party's specific role to take one example, you know, if you look at the financial crisis, right? The deregulation that drove a lot, that maybe arguably these things are really complicated, drove a lot of financial problems, was pushed through by Bill Clinton in the late 1990s. It wasn't pushed through by George W. Bush, and you know, a lot of the sort of push for home ownership that went on, that was pushed by Bush, was something that liberals were cheering him along. You know, so I think that issue in particular, it's, you know, I think everybody has a lot of apologizing to do on the financial crisis, and we're all somewhat responsible. It's less clear that the Republican Party is specifically responsible. But that being said, I think that, you know, it's true. The Republican Party screwed up a lot of things. And, you know, when parties screw up, it's, you know, they get voted out of office. And you know, and then it takes a while for them to come to terms with their defeat. But again, I think, you know, you can't expect too much, in the sense that you can't expect, it took the Democrats, you know, depending on how you count, 15, 20 years to recover from the loss of their majority. I'm hoping that, you know, it takes the Republicans 2 to 3 to 5 years. But I don't think we should be surprised that, you know, 6 months after Barack Obama took office, the Republican Party hasn't completely found its footing and hasn't found a brilliant message yet. I think you have to have a little more patience than that. And I think you can't expect, you know, look, American politicians don't go around apologizing as a general rule. This is true on the right and the left alike. You didn't hear, you know, Jimmy Carter did not spend the 1980s apologizing for, you know, for stagflation and the Iran hostage crisis. Maybe he should have, but he didn't. And I think, you know, the idea that Republicans are going to come out and just start apologizing en masse is it would be nice, but it's not how American politics works.
Forgive me here with just about a minute left, and maybe I should even be asking forgiveness for bringing up Sarah Palin and all.
But Sarah because Palin, everybody wants to know, yeah.
The question, you know, she's an interesting figure because she's somebody who has both very high positives and high negatives, you know, depending on who you ask. And certainly some people within the party still find her very appealing. Do you think that she has a future in the party?
Oh, I think she absolutely has a future. I mean, she's to a large swath of Americans, she's a tremendously attractive figure. But we only have a minute here. it's incredibly complicated. I think the thing to be said about Sarah Palin is that Sarah Palin's life story is the kind of life story that successful Republican politicians would have if the party was going to become a working and middle class party. You would have politicians who were sort of up by their bootstraps, you know, running against the system. I mean, nobody's more middle class America in her background than Sarah Palin, went to 5 colleges, a self-made woman, and so on. But I think you also have to have more than a nice life story. You have to be able to talk seriously about public policy, and so far Sarah Palin hasn't really done that. So I think that, you know, a lot of the criticisms of her public statements on policy are justified. So for Palin right now, she has to get, you know, there's about 45% of the country loves her. 45% of the country hates her. There's 10% that doesn't have that doesn't hate her. She needs to make some of those people like her, and I'm not sure she's going to be able to do that.
We're talking here this morning with Ross Douthat. He is online and op-ed columnist for The New York Times. You can read him there, and also you can look at the book he co-authored. It's titled Grand New Party, How Republicans Can Win the Working Class and Save the American Dream, now on paper, published by Anchor Books. Thanks very much for talking with us.
Oh, thanks so much for having me, David. It was a pleasure.